This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.
At the third stroke, it will be.
Well, hello and welcome to EUC Digest, your bi-weekly audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking about GPU acceleration in the EUC space. But before we dive into the parallel processing and other benefits related to GPU, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Erik van Klaveren, and I'm your host for this episode. And with me is Johan van Amersfoort. Hi, Johan. How are you holding on?
Yeah, really good. It's a bit warm at the moment, but that's surely mainly due to the weather. It's like really warm outside. It's mid of summer, so that's the biggest reason. But obviously, I'm doing GPU stuff in my lab, which is next to me. And GPUs are doing a lot of stuff at the moment.
Are hot.
Yes, definitely.
Literally.
I am training a lot of one of the demo applications I'm going to show at VMworld this year is currently training, and it's been doing that for 2 weeks already. So really looking forward to the result.
Great. But what did you find out about our guest?
Oh, dude, I found a lot of stuff. So today's guest is a real queen bee, or at least she has a bee queen. And did you also know that she had to drive in reverse to get back to the parking lot while she was working at a Belgium customer? Ooh, and talking about Belgium, you know, due to her family, she speaks a bit of Flemish. So we're definitely going to find that out.
Wow.
And another thing is that she is a huge fan of gin, and she has a huge and diverse gin collection at home. And some say it's more than all pubs combined in a 20-mile radius.
Wow. Yeah, I love my gin too. So,
and finally, I think, you know, she loves traveling when she's not traveling for business. So I guess she's mainly on the road while not drinking gin and working and other stuff. So.
Great. But Will, if you still don't know who our guest is, please, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you both. Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Mannion from NVIDIA. And yep, you are totally correct on all points. I don't know how you got all that information. But yeah, that's completely correct.
Yes, we have a big research department.
We know some guys and girls. Sarah, thank you for being on our show. Could you please explain our listeners who you are, what you do, and what people can recognize you from?
Yeah, sure. So I've been with NVIDIA for about 6 years now. So, you know, some of you might know me from NVIDIA, from Twitter. But I've worked in the EUC space for a long time. Before NVIDIA, I was at Microsoft, and I did many things there, from being an engineer for Windows Server and an engineer for virtualization. And that's how I came to NVIDIA. At the start of NVIDIA's journey for vGPU, they needed some people who understood the EUC space and understood virtualization to really help promote and to talk about vGPU capability. So that's how I came into the company. But before that, and even before Microsoft, I used to look after a product called Parallels Desktop for Mac that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. So for a very, very long time, I've been involved in this space, tried to get away from it for many, many times, but keep getting drawn back to the EUC world.
Wow, that's actually quite a resume.
It's been a journey.
Yeah, it actually is.
I said to people before that one of the things I guess most proud but also most ashamed of is that I used to have to support Hyper-V before Hyper-V had any live migration capabilities, which that's a tough job to
Wow, so it was back to the Adidas network, I guess, for live migration.
If you remember when Hyper-V first came out, there was no live migration and it was all very, very gooey. That was my product. That was, something I had to evangelize to customers, which was really hard.
I still remember the road shows in the Netherlands and Belgium. The guys here were given with Microsoft, and they showed this actually off. It was like really cool, really cool. Yeah. Like, yeah. I know some products who already. So, you are actually the first woman in our show.
Thank you. It's a shame it's taken so long, but yeah, there are few of us in this space, unfortunately. But that's sort of quite reflective of the industry, isn't it? I think.
Yeah. What's your take on that?
It's something I've been used to. You know, I've been in this space pretty much all of my working life. I started out as a first and second line tech support, you know, on the telephone. And all of my career, really, there have been very few women. I see more women in the database space, funnily enough. When I was at Microsoft, there were quite a few in the SQL space and the SQL team. I think it's very, very slowly changing. This is just quite reflective of our industry. It doesn't bother me. I think what's important is the capabilities. I would love to see more women, more ethnic minorities in our space. But what's most important is people having the right skills, you know, that they have the knowledge, the skills and the passion. I don't want to work with people who don't genuinely care and love the technology. That's what's important to me.
Yeah, so a passion for tech and doesn't really matter which or who, which person or who has that passion or shares the passion. But I think you're totally right there. Yeah. And do you think, because, you know, I've been working with a IT partner instead of a vendor. Do you think there is a difference in diversity between partners and vendors?
I think sometimes the size as well can be a real difference. You know, when at NVIDIA, when we are recommending to customers safe pairs of hands to work on projects, what we've tended to find is that a lot of the large vendors are just too large. But you have some of these small organizations who are specialists or consultants or IT partners, and they have that passion, and they have the individuals who have the passion who will take the time, as I know both of you would do, to learn about this technology that you are, you know, supporting for your customer. You've got that passion. You'll spend your spare time reading a white paper. You know, you have that interest. So I think that's really what I've seen is that the smaller, leaner organizations tend to have much more of that that interest and passion for technology. And the larger organizations just have the reach. It's a bit of a generalization, but that tends to be what we've seen with some of our emerging technologies.
Well, I think it's a great segue. Let's talk about those emerging technologies. So NVIDIA is, I think, commonly famous about their work in the GPU space. And I think my first GPUs and one of the first from NVIDIA was, I think, the GeForce 128.
Wow.
And, you know, they, like 20 years ago when we played like the first person shooters like Doom and Wolfenstein. And I think, you know, most people probably played those games on CPU accelerated graphics. But when the first like the monster 3D cars came out. And I know NVIDIA acquired Monster, I think in the early 2000s. You know, that was a big game changer in the GPU space. But that was 20 years ago already. So a lot has happened. And where do you see that NVIDIA is now? And are GPUs still relevant to the enterprise or to the market in general?
Wow. Big question. Yeah, it's... You either know what we do nowadays or you don't. And I'll be honest, when I got the call from NVIDIA to say, you know, we potentially have a job, would you be interested? My first thought was, oh, the gaming company. Because that is still, you know, I still speak to some of our customers and partners today, and that is the view. Because we're a component. You know, you don't think of all of the different areas that GPUs can be applied. I think that's still going to be around for probably most of the life of NVIDIA, I think. But it's only really been the last couple of years that the ability to use GPUs for compute and for AI particularly has really taken off. And I have no doubt that accelerated computing is a huge, huge part of the future of everything that we do. And I'd love that, you know, NVIDIA have a huge part in that. And we certainly do. You know, we power some of the most powerful computers that are on the planet. We heavily involved with many different governments around AI strategy, around the fight for COVID-19 because of our technology. But there are many other organizations who are looking to build similar technologies. You know, if you talk about quantum computing, it's trying to achieve the same goal. It's accelerated computing. And I love the fact that there are, you know, different applications trying to solve the same thing. We all know we've got bags and bags of data and we want to do more with it quicker. And that's exactly what NVIDIA is just trying to solve. So I think we will certainly be around and GPUs will have a part for a very long time. What I think we're starting to see is that technology is just becoming a commodity. And it is a commodity inside Azure and GCP and AWS, but people don't know it. And I think that's the concern, I guess, maybe for NVIDIANs is you might be using our technology and you don't know it. You know, you're watching a fantastic film that's been rendered using GPUs. You have no idea. And that's I think, what we are, I guess, wanting to make sure people are aware of is the technology that goes behind all of these great things.
But is it still a problem that NVIDIA has looked at as the gaming company or the gaming card, video card company?
No, it's not a problem. It's still a massive, massive part of our business. And the gaming customers are probably the toughest we have. You know, if I look back to some of the deployments that I've worked on historically, I'll go into banks, you know, the most high profile customers, they will accept more latency than a gaming user. You know, they are our most challenging customers and they push us for more and more power and performance. So we're hugely proud of that side of the business. It's just nice for us as an organization to have people aware of all of the other different business areas. Mm-hmm. Our company is quite unique that we are about just under 20,000 employees globally. So not a lot, but 3/4 of them are engineers. And it's about just trying to make sure that those people are recognized for the work they're doing. You know, that it's not just gaming, that there are applications to software and to code across all sorts of areas. And that's really what NVIDIA just want is just that awareness of all of the efforts in all the different directions of the technology.
Well, I think that's, again, a great segue because think in 2003, there was a team of researchers led by Ian Buck, and they created Brook. The Brook API, which is now commonly known as CUDA. So yeah. the CUDA toolkit or the CUDA instruction set or the CUDA framework that can be used to utilize a GPU or an accelerator to run code on it. So use it for acceleration of computations instead of just graphics. Do you think that rephrase that. What's the impact for NVIDIA since the revelation of Brook?
And this for me, this has been the foundation of everything that has come since. Absolutely spot on with all of the history of Brook, which now everyone knows as CUDA. And, you know, it's basically CUDA is the way that you can get your application to talk to the GPU and make use of it. And without that, you probably wouldn't have seen the use of GPU acceleration in compute and machine learning and deep learning. When we built this, when we first had CUDA, we didn't even have the Tesla GPUs, which we now use for the data center. You know, this was all for GeForce and for Quadro. And much of the stuff that's happened afterwards has really come from academics. There is a white paper that many of us at NVIDIA will quote as being the birth of deep learning. And it was a couple of Stanford PhD students who were using CUDA and a GeForce GPU so that they could do training and accelerate their training on a deep neural network. And this was, I think, about 2008. So absolutely for us, CUDA has just made all of that acceleration possible to so many different applications. And it started off being very, very slow, but now we've got a catalogue online that lists, you know, hundreds and hundreds of applications that are CUDA aware, that can take advantage of that acceleration. And we even have developers that we have internally to work with organisations to get their applications CUDA aware, so that hopefully we have a future that, you know, if there's a GPU, whatever you're using, it can take advantage of that acceleration, because nobody doesn't want their stuff to go faster, you know. So, without CUDA, without doubt, we wouldn't be seeing the use of acceleration of workloads on GPU.
So could you explain our listeners what the importance is of a GPU when talking about AI, machine learning, deep learning, and things like big data?
Sure. So really, really simple analogy is just the difference in terms of what a GPU does compared to a CPU. GPUs don't replace CPUs. They are a perfect addition to them. CPU, I like to think of as being like the brain of a computer. You know, it takes all of the jobs and tasks and processes them. But CPUs are very serial. You know, they take one job, complete it, and then do the next, which is why we always try and have the best and fastest CPU, because we want to get the most out of our environment. If you have a GPU and you have workloads that can talk to the GPU and be offloaded to the GPU, you have a different way of processing them, because a GPU isn't serial. A GPU is parallel. And what that means is that it can run multiple jobs simultaneously. And that has been perfect for graphics, which is why the GPU first came about. You know, you talked about the shoot 'em up games, and I used to play Unreal Tournament, Duke Nukem 3D, and I remember, you know, getting a graphics card, because to render that fast moving shoot 'em up environment, if you had to render every single piece serially, you know, it takes some time. But if you have a GPU that can take that whole frame and just render the whole image, but quickly on the fly, you get that real moving imagery. And that's just around graphics. But, you know, you take that into a compute space, something like deep learning or machine learning, a GPU will give acceleration anything from 10, 20, 50, 100 times the speed of using just CPUs. So it's really around just supercharging any form of processing. It just needs the workload to be able to talk to the GPU. And it's not necessarily something that, that can be used for everything. There are certain tasks on a computer that absolutely a CPU needs to do. But a GPU is perfect for anything graphical, anything computational, anything simulation to speed up and accelerate that workload.
And how does this relay in autonomous driving? How does this go from there?
So autonomous driving is probably a perfect example. You need the fastest decision-making possible in a car. If you are in a car that is driving itself and a small child steps out into the road, you don't want a car that needs to take some time to decide if it's going to stop or not. And we have been working on this challenge for some time. We started out working with Tesla, and Tesla have our GPUs in the early versions of their car. And the GPUs are made for that.
Now they don't?
Not anymore, no. So Elon's been trying to make his own GPU because I'll give you some history, and I don't know if I'm supposed to share this or not, but Elon wanted something custom for Tesla. Something that was only for them, which I can understand. But what we have been doing at NVIDIA is building something we call NVIDIA Drive, which is the GPU and the software, but we're making it available to everyone. And we've got 380 different automotive companies that are signed to use it. And, you know, as a consumer, I can see a benefit of all of the different types of cars in the future, maybe being able to talk to each other, you know, an open network effectively. Elon wants to do his own thing and he wants a completely separate environment, and we wouldn't do that for him. So he's been looking at how he does it himself. So there we go.
so Sarah, to dive into that, because I find, like we talked about in the introduction, I find autonomous driving or AI in general really, really interesting. And it's, to me, it's one of the topics I'm definitely going to dive into deeper in the next couple of years. But one of the things is that I find interesting is that you guys built a specific platform based on hardware and software to enable for autonomous driving. Why is that?
We do it. The reason why we do it is because it's hard. And that is something our CEO, Jensen, would say. It is a big challenge that needs to be solved. And, you know, we all know this. Whether you want to see autonomous vehicles or not, it's going to come. Every manufacturer wants to have that capability. And it's a big, big problem to solve. It's not easy. You know, you can make a robot autonomous. But if it goes wrong, it's not huge. It's no drama. For a true level 5 autonomous vehicle, it's a massive challenge. And it's one of the things that NVIDIA prides itself on is we can invest our R&D into these big challenges. So we've been working on this for a long time. And I say we started working on it with Tesla, with Elon. And it's such a big challenge because of the scale of that problem. Trying to train a vehicle to be fully autonomous, to make decisions, to make the right decisions, and it needs to do that as a single unit. Yes, you can have a relay of satellites, etc. But you know, the reason we have the GPUs in the car is because you can't rely on a trip to the data center to get an answer. You know, you have to have a vehicle that fully understands how to make decisions. So we have spent many, many years building NVIDIA Drive and Constellation, which is a full end-to-end solution. And most of that is around the training. And we have a simulation environment which simulates hours and hours and hours of driving on public roads that can be done before you put the software in the physical car. Because, you know, most of the public roads in most countries, you can't legally drive an autonomous vehicle on. So how do you get enough training hours, you know, to be able to trust the vehicle to know what it does? So we do that in simulation, and we do quite a lot of it in places like California, where we do have areas where we can use fully autonomous vehicles for training. But yeah, most of that is all done virtually and through software to iron out all of the potential issues. And we're not there yet, but we're getting there. We've got organisations like Deutsche Post DHL in Germany who are putting autonomous delivery vehicles on the roads, not necessarily on the public highways as yet, but they are working to have remote delivery vehicles. We've got BMW who have autonomous vehicles inside their plants. And these are all really, really good use cases for, you know, proving the technology that gives us the confidence to say, yes, we can have these on the public roads. But that's still a little bit of a way off. But yeah, that's what we've been doing is investing heavily in building the technology so that organizations can start to do this.
There still are two other problems, I think, that needs to be sorted out. That are rules and regulations of driving an autonomous car. Who is responsible if something happens? I think that's a major topic nowadays, because I believe these cars are coming, and they're coming pretty soon. But you have another problem, and that's the moment we have a 50-50 split. There's 50% of the cars are autonomous and self-driving, and the other 50 are steered by humans. And I think we can't interact with a car that's driving autonomous. And can react to that, because our brain isn't functioning the same way a GPU does. It's way faster. So I think there will be a pain point somewhere in between the 50-50 moment.
Well, the number of conditions in which an autonomous vehicle needs to respond or react is indefinite when you combine autonomous vehicles on a road together with manual driven vehicles, because and I think that makes for the complexity in achieving that level 5 autonomous vehicle instead of the other version. So sorry, I mentioned the level 5 autonomous vehicle. So there are 5 different levels. And could you explain our users our listeners what the difference is between the levels?
Yeah, sure. So yes, we have different levels, or, you know, level 5, level 3. These are just different gradings depending on what capabilities of automation that a vehicle has.
Level 5 is the holy grail, right?
Level 5 is completely autonomous vehicle, and we don't have that. What we have today is around level 3. So if you're familiar with maybe the Teslas, the Audi A8 has level 3 as well. And some of that can be different depending on the manufacturer. So some of those automated functions might even just be very simple, you know, radar, sensors, that sort of thing.
But this isn't regulated? Like level 3 is the same level 3 at all the car companies?
Level 3 is what tends to be called conditional automation, and some aspects of that driving can be done for you. But what's different is that the driver must be available or on hand to intervene. So if you've seen some of the funky cars that can park themselves, you know, and that's been around for a few years. Very, very cool. But legally, you know, you are still in charge of the vehicle. You have to be there to grab the wheel. And that's really what some of the difference is, where when you get into level four, it's about the cars being really fully autonomous and not really needing the driver, and level five being completely fully autonomous. That's the hands-off bit for all of us, and for regulation is that jump between my car can park itself, but I've got my hands on the steering wheel, to my car can park and drive itself, but I might have had a couple of beers and I'm not in the position to be able to, you know, take control back. And most of that difference isn't about technology and functionality. It's about regulation and safety. And for us to be able to prove that, you know, the vehicle is completely capable of being able to take care of those situations.
Yeah, I think this covers it really well. Let's talk about a different topic, because we were talking about Teslas and autonomous vehicles. Teslas nowadays have like a completely, I don't think it's like an Android system, although it might be, but a Tesla can be managed as an end user device. And we know that GPUs were or are being used in the EUC space for a long time now. So what's your take on how GPUs are being utilized currently in the EUC space, and where are you seeing that going?
It's an interesting question, because what I always think now is, where is the EUC space going? I've been at NVIDIA through the whole journey of GPUs coming into the virtualization space. You know, GPUs have certainly been in powerful workstations, but not really around EUC, certainly not until, I guess, the last 5 years. And even now, there's still a question from a lot of organizations of, you know, do we really need GPU acceleration? Windows 10 for us was a bit of a godsend in a way, because it's so graphical. I say this as a lifetime Mac user as well, you know. Windows has just become so heavy and clunky, but very, very graphical. The way we work is graphical. You know, we all have, you know, multiple monitors. We're using, if you're like me, a web browser that you never close 20 tabs on. You know, we all work differently. We all use, particularly now, applications like Zoom and Teams and all sorts of different collaboration tools. So that there is a need for acceleration there. And, you know, that for us has been why vGPU and the use of GPU in the EUC space has taken off. It's not just been about supporting graphics workloads. It's about supporting day-to-day workloads. But what we've seen over the last year is that the compute and AI side of things is changing things again. Most of the conversations that I've been involved with in the last year has just been about data center management. You know, how do we carve up basically our data center space for different things? You know, we've got our silo for our databases. We've got our silo for VDI. We want to have a little bit of a big data cluster over here. And it's back to the same conversation that I think I was having 15 years ago about, let's use some virtualization technology and just carve and slice up your data center as a resource. And with things like Kubernetes and Docker, it does feel like we've gone back to having a conversation we had after mainframes. But that's what I really see now, is that GPUs are starting to move away from being role specific, so for virtualization or for compute, and starting to just become a bit of a fabric of the data center. And the question is, how does an organization use their data center in the right way for all of these different use cases? So that's really what I see at the moment is really the question a lot of organizations are starting to think about EUC. How does this all blend into all of the other different aspects that I need to run for my company?
Do you see a role there for VDI by day, compute by night? So the repurposing of GPUs for let's say, general EUC use cases by day and repurposing them for computational workloads by night.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've spoken to a lot of organizations about that, and some don't even know it in that clear sense. So we have a manufacturing customer in the UK who we installed a really, really high performance virtualization environment for them, because they do a lot of design works with applications like ANSYS. You know, I got a call from them saying, you know, those GPUs that we have, could we use them to do compute? You know, they're not thinking VDI by day, you know, compute at night. What they're thinking of still is silos. And we're trying to bring it to them and say, do you know what? You don't need to go and buy a whole second environment to do this compute. What you need to do is to think about how you dynamically use your data center. So absolutely, we're seeing a lot of this kind of flexible data center, flexible use case, and yeah, using, also bringing in cloud for burst and scale capabilities where needed.
Yeah, that's kind of a second way I wanted to take. How do you see this going more and more into cloud?
It's really interesting. So I had a conversation with one of my old Microsoft colleagues who wanted to pick my brains about deep learning and AI. And I said to him that the vast majority of the real deep learning projects that we work on are all on-premise, or on-premises, depending on how you like to say that word. And he couldn't believe it because, you know, at Microsoft, everything is cloud, everything is Azure. But the amount of data that is required for real deep learning, so we're talking about autonomous vehicles earlier, you know, the amount of data you need for that, doing it in the cloud today, just no, there's no way. There's too much data. So we have really seen an emergence of back to, you know, physical environments, but that's for training. I'm sure in time, you know, that will change, that will start to go back to the cloud, but we've certainly seen a massive resurgence of bringing hardware back into a local data center for deep learning. For the EUC space, the other way. You know, I had a long career talking about building physical VDI environments, and we're seeing a lot of that go into the cloud, particularly on a Microsoft platform.
Yeah, and like you mentioned before, because those huge chunks of data reside on in the car, in the case of an autonomous car, you also require some GPUs on the edge.
Yeah.
Before it will send back to the data center or cloud.
Absolutely. And edge computing, it's something I find quite interesting, actually. It's always been the missing piece. If I go back a couple of years and, you know, we would go to factory floors and talk to them about how you can use, you know, computer vision and robotics and, you know, all of the sales pitch, you know, you can make this really cool autonomous factory. But, you know, if you have a whole load of cameras or a whole load of robots in a factory in the middle of nowhere, how do you get all that data that they're generating and do something with it quickly so that you can do something with that answer? And you need a huge amount of compute, and that means you need to have local compute, because otherwise you have latency. So edge computing, which I think is how everyone is referring to it, it's almost the missing piece of AI, and that hugely involves the cloud. It's, you know, take all of that data from all of these sensors or all of these cameras or robots, send it up to the cloud, and send back the, you know, the analysis real time. And that, particularly with the rise of 5G, that for me is like the missing piece of the puzzle to really have some of these technologies working as we've been talking about for many, many years.
So, yeah, so what? Oh, sorry, Eric.
Yeah, and of course, the capability of the machine who's collecting the data and anticipating on what is going on and not have to wait before the data comes back.
Yeah. A great example I've always given in presentations is to talk about things like CCTV cameras. In the UK, we have hundreds of thousands of them, but they're not smart. You know, they just record stuff. And there is no intelligence unless you have something that can real time analyze that video footage, identify something and act on it. You know, if you're filming someone breaking into a car, but it takes you however many milliseconds to identify that and alert someone, all you've got is a film of a car being stolen. You know, you have to have that real time analysis to be able to do something. And that cannot really rely on it on the data center. It's got to be processed at the edge. And so we've been working on that challenge. And I think almost every hardware vendor is producing edge solutions that work with the cloud so that they are low latency, highly secure, because you're potentially putting a box out in the middle of nowhere, and small form factor, so they can be fitted in small locations, but you've got to be able to utilize, you know, 3G, 4G, 5G for the communication aspect.
Yeah. You can ask your question, Johan, if you want to.
I did want to ask you about an example, but I think you gave a perfect example. One of the things that NVIDIA did, and this might be a different topic, but NVIDIA acquired Mellanox for like about just over 2 years ago. And yeah. I think we just recently during GTC, the online GTC, we saw the first actual solution combined from both NVIDIA as well as Mellanox being announced, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a journey. We've been working together as organizations, but if you know anything about mergers, it's taken some time, and we had to wait, obviously, for the official merger and for everything to complete before we could really start working together as a single company and bringing out joint solutions together.
And that first solution is, because Mellanox, for the people who don't know, is a real networking company, and they were really famous for low latency, high speed networks based on InfiniBand. You know, that type of networking is seriously essential when talking about high performance computing, deep learning, AI. So what's that new solution that has been announced?
Are you talking about the Fabric Manager or something else?
Well, the I think it's called the A100.
The DGX.
The DGX A100. So there's a few things that we've been doing with Mellanox, and internally, it's been a learning experience for all of us. We've both had to sort of really learn each other's portfolios and the capabilities. But many of our customers actually have had a bit of a head start on this because, as you say, Mellanox sell, you know, high-speed connectivity solutions, and many of our customers have that and have GPUs. So they've sort of been building them together. And that's really where we had come into working with Mellanox. There are a number of supercomputers globally that have chosen Mellanox and have chosen us. And we got to work together to figure out how to make these supercomputers really supercomputer. And we learned a lot about each other's solutions, hugely complementary. And we've really used that as the learning to put that into starting to build proper joint solutions. So we announced very, very recently a refresh of our DGX, which is our standalone deep learning supercomputer for training. And we've had multiple iterations of this, but we've just launched a new one. It's effectively the third iteration. And that absolutely has Mellanox Interconnect built into it. And this is, you know, built from the ground up together. And this has got Mellanox's InfiniBand and Ethernet network adapters with packing something ridiculous. I think it's something like 450 gigs a second of bandwidth. So
wow.
Ridiculous. Yeah. So hugely, hugely powerful. And the Mellanox stuff is really, really clever. You know, you mentioned the acquisition and merger. It was something like 6.9 billion, which sounds unbelievable. But, you know, we all know that if you're in the deep learning or compute space as a vendor or as a customer, it is all about how quickly can I get all of this data to go through my compute environment, but to do it properly and efficiently and to be able to take advantage of all of those GPUs. And Mellanox have that technology. So for us, it's a perfect partnership to start to be able to bring, you know, their technology to our GPUs. It was a match made in heaven for us. It really was.
Awesome.
So would that be a space to for NVIDIA to grow in? Because
yes.
NVIDIA absolutely. Started, I think, mobile GPUs a couple of years ago. You talked about 5G. So would that be a space where NVIDIA can make a difference?
It certainly is something that we are looking at. If you've seen the news, there are rumors about what we're doing with ARM, and you can just read the news on that. But yeah, you know, mobile of course. We've been involved in that space for a long time. We had a range called Tegra, you know, small GPUs that would go into phones and even things like the Microsoft Zune, if anyone remembers those.
Yeah.
And that sort of hasn't been a massive focus for us for a while. We do a lot with Jetson now. That's our brand for what we call anything that moves, anything autonomous, you know, robotics and stuff. But yes, there is a huge amount of capability. If you were to look at the space that ARM have heavily been involved in, with all of this new technology that we have with Mellanox, which is really about how do we really efficiently move data to various different parallel processing units. So, yeah, you know, there's lots of capabilities, but I think what we can see is the pattern that we've always had at NVIDIA is we build something and then we try and make it smaller and even more powerful. And, you know, the ARM piece, I think, will really open up all sorts of possibilities if that happens.
Cool. So I have one personal final question. So how far along is having my own Jarvis interface embedded in my smart glasses away?
Wow. If you really work on that, not that far away. So, you know, Jarvis for us has been a fantastic project. And Jarvis, if you're not familiar, is I can't even say the word, but multimodal AI. So joining in speech and vision and AI. We've been playing around with it at the NVIDIA store. So we have a Jarvis assistant that you can go in and talk to. And if you've ever been to our NVIDIA campus, we have a store because, you know, we're all really sad and we want to buy NVIDIA branded stuff. But you can go into the store and you can say, hey, what bags have you got? And this, you're talking to this assistant that can look around and say, we have this one. And then you can say, do you have it?
Isn't the person, right?
Yeah.
This is like a machine. Okay.
Like, yeah, you can build it into a robot. You can build it into a panel, whatever you choose. But we see this as being a massive thing for retail to, you know, to be able to have something you can talk to that understands its environment. But also manufacturing, to give that capability to robots so that you can say, hey, robot number 5, can you go over and get me that red spanner?
That's basically how Tony Stark did it as well, right?
Exactly. So, and that's exactly why it's called Jarvis, because, yeah.
So so is the Jarvis robot in the NVIDIA store also like powered by the voice of Paul Bettany?
No, we've got a different voice. But you can choose some of that. So, you know, Jarvis is an SDK. I think it's available. We've had it under early access for some time.
Yeah, it still is.
Okay. Only because we want to be able to give help and assistance. And if you make it public, we can't scale to that. So all of the organizations who've got early access, we are partnering and working with to help make that, whatever project they're trying to achieve, to make it a reality. But yeah, we see it hugely coming into, you know, certain industries, and you know, manufacturing and retail are key. But to answer your question, the capability is there. What's missing is the many, many thousands of hours of dev time to get it to work.
I must give you guys at NVIDIA a couple of compliments, because most of those innovative projects are freely available. And like you mentioned, Jarvis can be accessed through an early access request, but things like Clara, a project you could use to include deep learning and rendering into X-ray imaging, even with like older models of X-ray imaging equipment that don't support things like that. But also, you know, the whole NGC, so the NVIDIA Graphics Cloud platform, which I think you meant or you referred to earlier in the episode. NGC.NVIDIA.com has a great ecosystem of all sorts of applications, models, frameworks that you could download for free, all in Docker format. And it has been a huge help for me to try to understand what deep learning and machine learning is, and how you could use like simple examples and build simple applications based on those frameworks. And again, really big compliments for you guys opening up this ecosystem to the community and to everyone who is enthusiastic about acceleration and all sorts of use cases you could use that acceleration for.
There you go. Your free marketing.
No, thank you. And it is something that is almost like the hidden piece that everyone thinks of NVIDIA as GPUs and hardware, which is fine. But as you say, we have this repository on NGC, which is software that we're developing ourselves that is just freely available to the community. And yeah, you need a GPU to get the most out of it, of course. But we're huge community fans. You know, we of course make all of the software that we provide available because we want people to use it, to develop on it. But I think it is a really unknown aspect of what we do. You know, it's not just hardware. And here's a load of software that you can use to just get going. We've got a demo online that we call 2 days to a demo that takes you step by step to building a deep learning environment. And, you know, it's completely free. You can do it in using AWS. You don't need to buy a GPU. So, you know, doing stuff like that is also about giving back to the community. How do we make it easy for people to start to understand these skills, particularly around how to build, you know, neural networks, how to train? Because it's the future. It's something many of us are going to need to start to know how to do. So if we can put some of that stuff out there, I think it's a really, really good thing.
Cool. I have a final question as well.
Okay.
You already mentioned you're a long-time Mac user.
Yep.
What's NVIDIA's take on that?
I'll tell you a personal story about that, actually, because if you know the history of Mac, we used to have our GPUs in the iMac range, and that is no longer the case. And our CEO and their CEO had a bit of falling out about it. Anyway, long story short, my third day of employment at NVIDIA, I'm a bring-your-own-device person, so I don't have any corporate NVIDIA devices. They're all mine. Third day of employment, I sit down next to Jensen with my MacBook Air and my iPhone, and he just looks at me, looks at them, and he said, what are you doing with devices that don't have an NVIDIA GPU in them for your job? And because I was on the good team at that time, I said to him, I am using an NVIDIA GPU. I'm using it in the cloud because I'm using Grid. And he looked at me and he smiled and he went, great answer.
You fixed it.
Yeah. But yeah, they're just tools to do your job. You know, the same as we all talk about work is wherever you are. You know, my workload is wherever. Yeah, we've got loads of servers in our HQ that we've all got a personal space at, you know. So all of my devices are just ways that I access stuff. That's my excuse.
Yeah. It's actually true. So
exactly.
Before we wrap things up, is there anything you want to add or want to come back to, or maybe want to emphasize?
Oh gosh. No, not specifically. I think it's been a fantastic conversation. We've covered so much. I think that's part of the challenge, isn't it? That NVIDIA actually cover so many different areas, so many different technologies and projects. We've got a finger in all of them, and it's been fantastic to have that conversation.
Well, I think it perfectly reflects the diverse the extensive amount of use cases or number of use cases that GPU nowadays has. And that's not just tied to graphical acceleration for games. It's so much more. And I think it completely exploded.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
In a good way.
And it's going to continue to evolve and change. And it's an exciting journey. You know, being in this space is very exciting, you know. Things change in 6 month increments, so it's very, very cool.
We're looking forward to the next changes, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's good stuff coming. You know, we've just announced Ampere, which is our next architecture following Volta. So you know, we've got a whole load of new stuff that we're going to be bringing to the table. So exciting times.
Hopefully. With the doors better open and when we can get outside and talk to each other again in person.
With a beer. That would be great.
Or multiple beers.
G&T.
Absolutely. I would look forward to that very much.
So we opened up the conversation talking about liquor, and we're probably going to close it down talking about liquor as well. Dude, I feel the urge for having a beer at the moment.
I still have some gin and tonics over here, so I'll probably grab that.
I'm still trying to figure out how you knew I had my gin closet. I must have told one of you at one point, but you were spot on.
A magician's secret, right? So we never tell.
Never reveal the tricks.
No, we seriously have like a big team of researchers working on this stuff, and we always find like the clean dirt, I would say.
Yeah. The ones who can be told.
No problem. I horrendously overshare anyway, particularly if I've had a few drinks. So
So thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed this snack as we try to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite.
So Eric, can I interpret you? Can I?
Like, yeah, sure.
Yes. So so Sarah, if people want to know more about you or the work you do or NVIDIA in general, where can they find everything to know?
Wow. So you want to know more about NVIDIA, go to our website. Go to NVIDIA.com or NVIDIA.eu. There's tons of stuff there. Or just reach out to me. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Sarah Mannion UK. just get in touch. Very, very happy to talk to anyone about technology. So yeah, if there's anything that we've talked about today and you think, oh, I'd like to know more, just hit me up.
Cool.
Great. So I can continue.
Yes, please do.
Cool. Okay. If you have anything you want to add here or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on the social channels or by email at podcast@eucdigest.com. Cheers, love, and rockets.
This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation Edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high-performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.